Hi there. I'm going to talk. So we've seen a nice progression here in our presentations. We're going from young child, early childhood to early childhood all the way to early 20s, and then in Tony's talk, from middle childhood into early 20s. I'm going to try to take us even further along the age spectrum and have a full lifespan. So I'm going to be talking about some data that that were collected looking at 30 years later what individuals with autism look like. These are going to be individuals who are in their 30s, 40s, and into their early 50s. So as Tony already pointed out, we don't know a lot about what middle adulthood looks like in individuals with autism. There are a large number of studies that are starting to look at young adults, transition-aged individuals, but there's really three larger samples that have existed and been published about so far, from Pat Howland's lab, from Marsha Malik's lab, and from Christopher Gilberg's lab, that take us into the 30s and 40s. A couple of the kinds of things that we do know about is that it appears that intellectual functioning may be relatively stable into middle adulthood. Tony's finding data that show actually a nice improvement. There is some plateau or stopping of increasing in daily living skills into middle adulthood as well, it seems. But we don't really know that much. So what we're going to talk about is some research that's been done at the Teach Autism program. Just a little bit about the Teach Autism program. It's a statewide, university-based set of regional clinics that's centered at UNC Chapel Hill. It was created in 1965 by Eric Schoppler. We think that it is the oldest university-based autism program in the United States. Because it is a regional center, we have clinics in the whole state. Certainly in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, virtually every person with autism, every person diagnosed with autism in the state of North Carolina probably came through Teach at some point or other. It offered free services until the early 2010s. So we collected information from the wide spectrum of socioeconomic and racial diverse population of our state. So this longevity of the Teach Autism program provided an opportunity to follow individuals from early childhood into adulthood, and that's what this research has been about. We do have, again, this is a sort of just an interesting tidbit, we have 20,000 individuals in a registry at UNC. I'll point out that we have, again, this is an odd thing that I don't know if it's actually true, but I'm trying to collect information about whether it is. I believe we have the longest continuously operating IRB approval in the United States. We've been approved since 1969. and that allows us to do records review research and to contact individuals for participation in future studies. Great forward thinking by Dr. Eric Schoppler. So we've been conducting for the last couple years this autism in adulthood research project. It's been funded initially by the Foundation of Hope and then after that by Autism Speaks. It's had two components, a caregiver survey as well as some in-person testing. I want to talk a little bit about our recruitment process because it's kind of complex. So we started with individual clinical records from the late 60s into the mid 90s. It turns out that there are roughly 7,000 clinical records of individuals who were assessed at Teach during that time period. About 3,300 of those met our study criterion, which was to have individuals over 30 who had a confirmed diagnosis with autism and were diagnosed before the age of 16, okay? So we started with 3,300 individuals. Now, many of these individuals we hadn't had contact with since, say, 1972. We had to find them. This was actually a challenging thing. We used some marketing software that marketers use to track all of you. You know, when your undergraduate school contacts you after you've moved, they've contacted you because a marketing firm has found you based on your previous address and your birth date and whatnot. We used that. And we found what looked like good addresses for about half of those individuals, 1,700 of those 3,300 individuals. That's not bad. Of course, we don't really know, since some of those are 40-year-old addresses that we started with, whether those are really good addresses or not. So we mailed out information about the study to all of those 1,700 families. 1,200 of them we never heard back from in some way or another. Some of them, about 300, we did get returned mail saying they were not at that address. The other 800 were either individuals that we just never heard back from, and we have no idea if it was a correct address or not. and individuals that we had an address and phone number for. We tried contacting them by phone, but we could not hear from them also. We did not get a hold of them ever. So we were left with 529 families that we actually had contact with. 77 said no. That's actually a fairly small percentage, given that this was 30, 40 years afterwards to contact them. 20 were deceased. 24, once we talked to the families more extensively, we realized they didn't fit our study criteria, so some were diagnosed with autism in 1973, perhaps, but now we found out, oh, it's really a Rett syndrome diagnosis. And we were left with 408 that we enrolled into the study. Roughly 330 of those individuals actually completed the full survey. So one of the arguments I do want to make from this is this looks like, even though it's a small subsample of this whole population, in lots of ways it looks like a pretty good representation from our state. When we do statistics to actually look at those who agreed to participate versus didn't agree to participate, or those who participated versus those we couldn't get hold of, their childhood scores look remarkably similar. So we think, in fact, at least the people that we got hold of are probably fairly representative of the larger population. So there's two phases, as I pointed out. We've talked at previous times about the caregiver and adult surveys of the individuals with autism and their caregivers. Today I'm going to focus on the in-person assessment. So we brought a subset of our whole sample in for actual in-person assessments. The goals of the study then were to describe the functioning of adults with autism. These are all adults with autism diagnosed during childhood, including ASD symptoms, IQ, intellectual functioning, and adaptive behavior, to examine the relationship then from child to adult functioning. Just to point out what the measures we used were, the first one we used that we had on all of the individuals during childhood, in fact, was the Childhood Autism Rating Scale. Eric Schoppler created in 1967, one of the first measurements of autism symptomatology. We were lucky enough then to have that for all of our individuals, and there's a current CARS 2 that's been updated that we could use to compare. We also have the ADOS on all the individuals who came in for in-person assessment, although we don't have childhood scores, obviously, because there were no childhood scores from Kathy back in the 1960s or 70s on the ADOS yet. We have intellectual functioning both in childhood and in adulthood. We've used the Stanford-Binet 5 as our measure for adult intellectual functioning. The childhood measures are a wide variety of measures. This is obviously going from the late 60s all the way into the early 90s. We have whisks on folks. We have Merrill Palmers on folks and Baileys and lighters, all sorts of things. Daily living scale, we measured the Vineland 2. We used the Vineland 2 to measure current adaptive behavior. For childhood, we have both Vineland social maturity scales, which is the very first version, and then the Vineland adaptive behavior scale, the first, as measures from childhood, dependent upon the individual and when they were diagnosed, which we had. We also do have, I want to point out, a wide variety of cognitive measures, executive function measures, motor tasks, a wide variety of other stuff, some qualitative interviews with caregivers. I'm not going to talk about that today. I just want to point out that is in there. So to compare again, sort of thinking about, is our sample representative? We do have the sample of 55 individuals. They look a lot like the 278 that we got full caregiver responses from. So their ages are similar, their male-female ratio is similar, their ethnic and racial distributions are very similar. So what they looked like in childhood, what this group looked like in childhood, they were diagnosed on average at 6 years old, although the diagnosis range went from 2 years old all the way up to 16. Their average CARS score was 32, where a 29, I believe, is the cutoff for that measure. Their average IQ was a 71. About 40% had an IQ in the normal range. The other 60% were more in intellectual disability range. And their Vineland scores, either on the Vineland Social Maturity Scale or the VABS, was 61, below their IQ. For this group, we find that, you know, a little bit less optimistic maybe than Tony's group, 46% were employed, currently. And 58%, and that's actually kind of shocking to me. This is individuals who are on average 35 years old, many of them in their 50s, 58% still live with family, okay? 15% do live independently. The remaining group live within care facilities of some sort, either group homes or other independent care facilities. So one thing we wanted to look at simply was these individuals who were diagnosed in the 70s and 80s, do they still meet diagnostic criterion for autism? First thing we looked at was the CARS scores. So on the CARS scores, we get this distribution that looks like an N on the CARS for the high-functioning version of the CARS 2. A 27 is the cutoff for meeting diagnostic criteria. Of the 55 individuals, 52 of them meet diagnostic criterion by the CARS. Three of them are below the cutoff, okay? All of those three are high-functioning individuals with high IQs. Not surprisingly, all the remaining group meets diagnostic criterion. When we did ADOSs also on the same group, only one individual did not meet diagnostic criteria. You can see that there are three individuals who are quite low there. Two of them met diagnostic criterion for autism spectrum, but barely, but not by a lot. And one individual did not meet diagnostic criteria, and by clinical judgment, that one individual was determined not to really show signs of autism. Only one. I do want to point out the ADOS there is only on 28 individuals. This is the individuals who we have ADOS 4s on, the higher functioning individuals. For the lower functioning individuals, what we did was Vanessa was wonderful and trained Joanna Mussey, one of our head clinicians, on the adapted ADOS, which isn't published yet, but the adapted ADOS takes some of the more childlike components of the Module 1 and Module 2 and makes it appropriate by taking those childlike components out for individuals with intellectual disabilities to give a Module 1 and Module 2 to. We'll hopefully have data on those actual scores from the adapted ADOS soon. Intellectual functioning, a little bit different from Tony's findings. We find, well, and we do certainly have a different sample. We find first that we have a pretty intellectually impaired group here, right? A 40 is the floor score, the lowest possible score on the Stanford-Binet. We find that, in fact, a sizable portion of our individuals have a 40, but we do also have a decent portion who are in the higher IQ range and some that are in that borderline range. So it is a wide variety of IQ functioning, with a mean of 67 on the Stanford-Binet. One thing we did look at was the correlation between between nonverbal and verbal IQ across this wide intellectual range. What we find is that, now I'll point out there's two lines here. It looks like one line, but there's two lines here. The black line is the line with a slope of one. So if your nonverbal IQ matched exactly your verbal IQ, that's where you would expect data to be. In fact, our data look exactly like that line, right? It's relatively superimposed on it. Over our whole population, nonverbal IQ comes out very close to what you would expect for verbal IQ. And in fact, you know, there are people, of course, who have higher verbal than nonverbal and people with higher nonverbal than verbal, but it looks very much like you'd find in the normal neurotypical population here. Next, what was adaptive behavior functioning like in these individuals? Well, we find that, in fact, there's relatively low scores. Again, many who have low scores or the floor of the Vineland 2 is a 20, so we find a lot of individuals who are at that floor. The mean was 47 on that score. Now, if we compare Vineland's to IQ, we see that there's a large difference. Now, of course, the problem here is that the IQ measure has a floor of 40. The Vineland has a floor of 20, so we need to correct that. And we simply converted all Vinelands below 40 to 40 to make them on a comparable scale. We still see that, in fact, there's pretty much a full standard deviation, you know, 13 points where 15 points is the standard deviation of decreased functioning on adaptive behavior compared to what you would expect based on their intellectual ability. And if you look at that just in terms of that relationship, in terms of what scores there are, that difference is especially in the higher functioning individuals, right? So those with higher IQs show greater differences overall in their adaptive behavior compared than the lower functioning individuals. Next, we wanted to look at the relationship between child and adult functioning. On the CARS, on the Childhood Autism Rating Scale, we see that, again, for all of these, the black line is the line with a slope of one if childhood matched exactly adult functioning. The blue line represents the actual slope of those relationships. We find that the two are related. Those with more severe adult child symptoms have more severe adult symptoms, but the correlation is only 0.34. It's a really modest correlation. And this is largely probably because the kinds of symptoms that people show as adults are going to be very different from those that they show in childhood, and they may not be necessarily strongly related. In terms of just difference in total score, there is no difference in total score on the CARS. In terms of IQ, we see, again, a very strong relationship here between childhood functioning and adult functioning. The correlation between child functioning and adult functioning is a 0.72 correlation. Now, in typical adults across this age range from 6 to 36, we might expect a 0.8 to 0.85 correlation. So it's actually quite close. You will see, though, let's see if I can use this mouse here, that there are a cluster of individuals here who had very low scores in childhood who now have high functioning scores in adulthood. There's also a cluster of folks down here who had higher scores, those same sort of borderline scores during childhood, who have very low scores during adulthood. We're still looking at that and trying to figure out what factors might actually predict whether you're likely to end up in that higher than you expect group or that lower than you might expect group. If you look overall, again, a slightly different message than what we saw in Tony's data, we actually see from childhood to adulthood a slight significant, although I want to say a very small, drop in IQ. So the IQ drops 4 points in this case. It's a very small amount of IQ drop, but it is a statistically significant drop. If we look at adaptive behavior, we see something similar. We see a relatively high correlation between childhood and adult adaptive behavior, a 0.53 correlation. So they are correlated. But again, we see that there are many more people below that black line than above. So there are many more people who are showing lower than you might expect adaptive behavior in adulthood based on what their childhood adaptive behavior was. And we see, in fact, a very large difference there between childhood and adult scores. So if we look at just the overall child and adult scores, we see about a 16-point drop in standard score on the adaptive behavior measure on the Vineland. Last thing I just want to mention is we looked at the relationship of these variables to a wide variety of outcome measures, including quality of life, employment, friendships. I'm just going to present one of those. The single best predictor of all of those outcomes is the daily living subscale on the Vineland. The daily living subscale is correlated 0.63 with quality of life on the Shaylock and Keith quality of life questionnaire. It's also the largest unique predictor of current employment on using logistic regression. It's the highest predictor of having friends. It is our best predictor. So just some general conclusions to point out. First, we do have substantial, stable diagnosis and really pretty stable intellectual functioning in this group 30 years after they were diagnosed. However, adaptive behavior is actually dropping in some pretty substantial rates using the same, an updated but same measure of adaptive behavior. And then finally, adaptive behavior really is the best predictor of these outcomes. And for us, that's a really important thing. We can't, into adulthood, these 35, 40-year-olds, we can't change very easily their intellectual functioning. But we can teach individuals with autism new independent living skills. And I want to point out really strongly that that's an important thing for all individuals working with adults with autism. Work on those independent living skills. If you can teach them to make meals by themselves, if you can teach them to use public transportation on their own, you're going to change that person's life to make them have a higher quality of life, be more likely to have sustained employment. That's really important. I do want to point out that we have a large lab group who made this all possible. Here's a large group of them, and we have funding from Foundation of Hope and Autism Speaks that we're very grateful for funding this project. Thank you.